Three, two, one.
It's Shazam!
The podcast that hopes to make itself obsolete.
I'm Kayla.
And I'm Carissa. And...
guys, this week I met literally a god, and she's a god, and we had lunch, and then I was sweaty, and then it was amazing, and then you guys get ready, because, oh, whoa, I need a break.
I'm so glad you didn't overstate it. Here we go!
I think that's perfect too.
Okay, great. Cool. So Kayla and I are really excited. I got to actually meet our guest today. We shouldn't be coy about it because it's in the title. So people know it's Ginger.
Guys, I can't even speak. I'm too excited. This episode.
So I'm not in this episode. I was up in Edmonton. I was on my way to do a still walking gig, and the timing just didn't work out. So Kayla got to this interview on her own.
The timing didn't work out. It was really my fault because we had this plan to record, and then I got into a deep conversation that suddenly was like an hour and a half to 2 hours long. And then I looked at my phone, and Carissa's like, "I have to go." I'm so sorry.
That's totally cool.
This is the most amount of sorry, not sorry I've ever felt in my life. Because then I just got to hang out with literally my hero for 4 hours, and it was grand. And so I'm very excited for you guys to hear this episode with Ginger Kalen. We talk a lot about her. She gave a speech last year at Magic Live, right? And I wasn't there. Krista, do you want to just like quickly touch upon what that talk was?
Yeah, it was phenomenal. And so she was backstage reviewing her cards, her cue cards, and she was a little nervous to go out. And she ended up being just so compelling and so interesting to listen to. And she was talking about how the word assistant is like the A word to her. She doesn't want to say assistant. She thinks of herself as a partner, and of course she is. You know, and she's got her own magic routine in the show that's beautiful and stunning. And she was talking about, like, kind of her process and how her and Mark have evolved their show over the years, and how all of this help that they got from different people and sort of her perspective. And it was a lot of things. But I think the core of it for me, from what I took from it, was this idea that, you know, she is a partner. She is part of a partnership. She's been designing and making magic for years, and she wants to be seen and respected as such. And it was so compelling and beautiful, and just she's just such a warm person and such an interesting character. And before Kayla went off to do the interview, she was texting me these hilarious texts about her sweat flop, cold sweat that she was having because you were so nervous, which is so funny because for me, when I have the gift of getting to meet Ginger kind of separate from Mark because she was doing the talk on her own. Mark wasn't backstage with her. And so I feel like I got to know her a little bit and I got to have like a, you know, meet the real person. And it's such a gift. So it's hilarious because to you, she is. And I mean, it makes sense that she's a god to you because she's so amazing and talented and compelling and elegant and just wonderful.
Yeah, I speak a little bit about this in our interview, but the first time I ever saw Mark and Ginger perform was in their Carnival of Wonder show. And from that moment on, it was like I couldn't look at them. I didn't feel like I was worthy enough to be in their presence, which is such a weird thing for me to say. Like, gosh, I've been in the presence of such amazing, big-named, famous people and felt no nerves and no sweat and no concern for making a fool out of myself. And it just like celebrity status has usually meant nothing to me, but there's something about Mark and Ginger that just got me and I just couldn't handle myself. And so over the last few years, I've had sort of chance run-ins with them. And every time I do the little like schoolgirl laugh where I'm like, oh, bye. And then just run because I can't handle it. And so it wasn't until, I mean, this was such a great opportunity selfishly for me to be able to sit down with Ginger and get to speak with her and get to know her. And absolutely, like from start to finish, gosh, I've never had to act so much in my life, just like pretending to be nonchalant and comfortable the entire time. But really, I've got sweat stains up the wazoo. and it is terrible.
Literally, up a in.
The Wazoo stands for armpits, everyone. I'm sweating from my armpits. What are you talking about?
Nothing. Nothing.
Nothing. And so yeah, this is a really special episode for me. I'm very excited about it. And is there anything else we should say before we just dive into the glory that is Ginger Kaelin? Oh, yes, there are a couple of things.
There are a couple of things. One.
Yes.
Do you want to say it? Should we say it?
We could not find a viable place to record. And the only place we could find was in the corner of the restaurant in the hotel Ginger was staying in. You will hear some background music. Guess what, guys? I didn't edit that one in. This wasn't on me, okay? This was not my stupid, I'm going to revolutionize podcast thought process anymore. There is some music in the background. Our editor, Jeff, has done his absolute best, as he is a genius, to try to get some of it out. It wasn't possible. So please bear with it. It's totally fine. Add some rhythm. We just add a little flavor to this interview that didn't need flavoring at all and didn't need spice.
I think it's totally worth it for me, you know, once you start listening, I just stopped even hearing it after a while. But yeah, we did want to apologize in advance that it's maybe not the cleanest recording, not the quality that you guys have come to be used to with Shazam since we got the new mics and the new editor. But I think totally worth it. I'm so happy you got to do this interview, Kayla. You know, Shazam is making our dreams come true as well, which is so great. And then as a way of getting back to you, not at all. It just so happened to work out that way that you weren't able to Skype in for the interview I did as part of the Women in Magic Week at the Chicago Magic Lounge with Jade and Alba. So we'll have that one as well where I will be on my own for that one. So we're even. It's all good.
I think it's wonderful. I love it. Amazing. So shall we?
We shall. Enjoy the episode, you guys.
Have fun. All right. So unfortunately, Carissa is not here for this one, so get ready for some banter by myself. Hey, Kayla, we have a guest today. Wow, Kayla, that's so cool. Kayla, did you know our guest was in World's Greatest Magic 2 and NBC's Hidden Secrets of Magic, both on TV in the 90s? Wow, Kayla, that's real cool. Did you know that our guest was one half of the Magicians of the Year of 1997 from the Academy of Magical Arts? That's right. I said magicians. Wow. Kayla, did you know that our guest co-owned the Magic Underground, a subterranean 200-seat cabaret theater in Reno, Nevada? Wow, that's crazy. Kayla, did you know our guest was a co-creator of Carnival of Wonders, literally the best magic show to ever exist? Wow, did you know our guest can be seen as the Conjuress and the hit touring show The Illusionist? Our guest has been part of magic for 27 years, and she is a partner and illusionist in the hit duo of Kaelin and Ginger. Guys, welcome Ginger Kaelin.
Hello! Wow, quite an introduction.
Yeah, we have fun. Well, I have fun.
I hardly miss Carissa.
Oh, please tell her that.
She will hear this later. No.
I love you, Chris. I miss you. This is great. I'm so happy you're here. As anybody who would have listened to this podcast before, I've talked about you a couple of times.
Really?
Because you're great. So I'm just so excited that you're here.
Oh, it's a lot to live up to.
We've been chatting for the better part of the last hour and a half, so mm-hmm. I feel pretty good.
Okay.
I'm not as sweaty.
Okay.
I'm nervous. So this is so exciting.
Maybe I'm more nervous now.
No, don't be. It's just a microphone. This is so great. So, Ginger, everyone knows you as part mm-hmm. of the duo of Kaelin and Ginger, as well as part of the Illusionist Taurus, the Conjuress. Can you give us a little bit of back history on how you got your start in magic?
Oh my gosh. Well, that's when we met. When I met Mark, really was my start in magic. I had actually done, it's a very unknown fact, but I had actually performed one illusion before I met Mr. Kaelin.
Oh, wait, what was it?
I know, this is a very hidden story. I was part of a group in Southern California called the Young Americans. And we were performing, we were putting together a tour for Japan for Fuji Television. And it was a big show, big, you know, 2.5 hour variety song and dance show. And in one of the pieces, we needed one of the guys to vanish. They brought in Ray Pierce to teach us an illusion. And I was one of the two girls that performed the illusion in the things. So that was my first experience of magic.
That's so cool.
I know, it's kind of bizarre. But anyway, going back to how I really began the career is in 1991, I was in a show called American Glitz in Guam. And so was Mark Kalin. And he was performing as one of the variety acts in that show. And there was two at the time. And kind of a long story, but I was one of the dancers in the show. I actually had the lead role, which was great for a short girl like me. And before the director, who was Jerry Jackson, who also produced the Folies Bergère in Vegas, this was the sister show. Anyway, he appointed me the understudy for the lead singer.
Did you sing?
Yes.
Okay.
But
okay.
Very strangely, she actually had an incident where she had to fly back to the States because she had a retina detached from her eye.
Jeez.
So I went into the role like within a day, and they kept me in that role for the remainder of the contract. So it was fabulous. I was one of the stars of the show, but I wasn't doing what I loved. Mm. I wasn't really performing like movement and dance and, you know, expressing myself like I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
So I decided that I was going to leave that contract, or not in the middle, but finish out.
Sure.
And then at the end of the 6 months, I would watch the show from the front for the first time. And that was the first time that I actually, not from the side stage, but seen the magic, you know, from an audience point of view.
Hmm.
The first thing I noticed was, obviously, it was just amazing magic. It was flawless. It was like the most solid 15 minutes of illusions you've ever seen. And Mark had this amazing chemistry with the audience that I was inspired by. I was motivated. I think I was moved more than I even expected. It was something that really super appealed to me. So after that show, I went up to him and I said, you know, I don't normally do this, but if you ever want somebody to work with, I would love to give it a shot. I mean, I just was shooting out of the blue, didn't know what the heck, you know, was going to come of it. And he said, well, as a matter of fact, the girl that I'm working with right now needs some time off, like about 5 weeks. She's going to go get married back in the States or whatever. Would you consider coming back to the island? Oh, like in a few months? Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. And he later told me that he had ulterior motives.
Oh.
But no, they weren't romantic. They were actually professional.
Oh.
He said that he wanted to just get a good demo reel with me. So I was very flattered. But anyway, so I came back in 3 months. And I was supposed to fill in for those 5 weeks, and I learned the illusions that were presented to me so far, that, and I immediately took to it. It was like, okay, probably within the first month, there was huge chemistry between the two of us.
Yeah.
On stage at first, and off stage, it was like I met my equal, my partner, you know, in life.
Yeah.
And then in the performance, it was just like, okay, this is what I'm meant to do. And I really stopped looking for something else because I thought that this profession, magic especially, would never bore me. It would always be a challenge. I could always improve. There's always a way to make it better. There's so much psychology. There's so much audience analyzation. There's so much ways to improve tricks and how to present them and like what's going to get them to applaud here and what are they thinking and how are they feeling. And it was like something I didn't know I had in me, but and he allowed it. So that's how I started.
That's so. I always find, and we talk about this on the podcast a lot, is that coming from different artistic backgrounds really helps magic. And so
I think for me, I
started very young in magic, so I didn't really get to come from an outside perspective too much, but I studied so much else. Carissa actually came into it a little bit later in life, so she was able to take a lot into it. So I always find that that's really amazing to be able to take something like a dance background and put it into magic. Can you touch upon that? Like, what are some examples of things that you've taken from your dance background and put into
a show? So much. I mean, dance and a little bit of theater.
Yeah.
You know, just performance styles and just learning how to incorporate the mood of something. You know, there's, you know how when you listen to different pieces of music, it inspires a different style of movement, and I think it's the same. I applied that towards the magic. You know, when we chose a certain piece, when we were adding new material into our repertoire, you know, very early on, you know, you look at the prop design, you look at the prop effect. Obviously, the prop effect comes first, and your choice of presentation and all those things, you know, give you a performance style that I probably learned through dance, because you wouldn't perform a jazz routine the same as you would perform a hip-hop routine or a tap or a ballet. You know, you take on a different persona and you deliver it or execute it with a different mentality. And so I approached that with magic. You know, our transfiguration in the very beginning was, you know, nothing like, you know, the interlude, or nothing like, you know, the very first trick I ever learned was the blammo box.
you know,
yeah. So it's just, you know, you learn how to vary and change things, and I think make it interesting for the audience.
Yeah.
So I guess that came also from my dance and theater background.
Yeah, it's the textures, right? It's
the textures.
Thinking about Carnival of Wonders is that show literally offers every single texture of performance you could imagine. It's got, you know, it's got the levitation, you've got the multiplying balls, which is like a, you know, very intimate style texture, but then you move on to Tunnel of Love, and like, you've got so much going on within that show that it really varies it up so that you can emotionally attach to the show, and then leave that emotional attachment, go into another one, which is so important.
And that was the success. That was exactly the success factor. I mean, the equation of the success of Carnival of Wonders is that the magic was used as the tool within the realms to express the different emotions. Mm-hmm. So it the framework of that show in itself allowed for the magic to shine, because it was all about the magic of life, and sometimes it's scary and sometimes it's funny and sometimes it's, you know, outrageous.
You
just gotta go with it and just embrace it.
Yeah.
But I that's one of the biggest comments that I give to other performers now, if I'm like kind of coaching or directing other performers, is to vary their delivery of things in a multitude of ways and take it as a personal challenge. So if you have three effects in your set or in your act, you're gonna wanna make those three effects as diverse as possible, as different as possible. So if you end the same way, you know, vary it. Mm-hmm. If you deliver a lot, you know, challenge yourself to find a new way, or relax enough to take a risk. And if you're gonna say a scripted, you know, segment, say it, try it five different ways. You know, you're gonna find something in that and yeah, you just learn that from experience.
Yeah, but absolutely. Yeah. I think that's great. In terms of coming from your background, did you have much of a speaking background on stage? You know where I'm going with this.
Yes. No, actually I didn't. In fact, even in The Young Americans, I remember there was one time that I was the shy girl. You know, I was very shy growing up, and I think that's why my dance persona was so strong.
Yeah.
You know, that's where I felt very powerful, and people would talk to me afterwards like, your voice is so soft, and you're not the persona. You have like a two-sided persona. You're like a devil on stage and an angel up. I'm like, yeah, that's me.
Yeah.
But I remember one time in The Young Americans, they gave me this intro to do, this like tap intro. And I was so excited that I was like getting the opportunity, but I was scared to death, you know, to do it. So I just didn't do it that much, you know. I didn't have a lot of speaking roles. I didn't have a lot of experience in talking. The most talking that I ever did was when I would teach and teach classes, and that I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
So when I started performing with Mark, all our stuff was visual, you know, powerful. I mean, even he will admit, when he started speaking on stage, he wasn't that great at it. You know, he listens to it. He listens to himself now, and he goes, "Oh my God!" You know, but he became a fantastic storyteller. He became like, his voice is very nice to listen to on stage. Mm-hmm. You know, and anyway, the evolution came with the Wakeling. The Wakeling sawing in half was a trick that we decided to add to our repertoire for various reasons. You know, we were told that offstage we were like, what's the duo? Sorry.
Gracie and Burns.
Burns and Gracie. Okay, so we started taking some improv classes, and even though I wasn't very good at the improv, we were really funny offstage, you know, just being a couple. And our personalities, I guess. So people were like, well, you should do some of this on stage. And when we decided to do the Wakeling, and because I was so resistant to being inside a box and faces, I'm like, I'm not even, you know, I'm doing the trick, but I'm not even there, you know. and we decided to have a microphone, and this was the opportunity to do that very same thing. So we loosely scripted it ahead of time, but it was really through the course of evolution and through my honesty and vulnerability with speaking, and then I had to like kind of like lose myself in the volunteers. So that's where those moments came from, which ended up being power moments, but I didn't know it at the time. It actually was my safety. You know, when I was speaking and I had to speak on stage, it was better if I didn't think of saying it so that the audience could hear, but actually speaking to the volunteers and then letting the audience in on that. So it became more about them and I, and that's where that whole persona came from. That's where the funny came from. That's where the comfort came from. That's where the power came from. So it was really, and then I started to get laughs in certain places, and I was like, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and there's so much power in laughter and in making people laugh. You know, it was a discovery that was just priceless.
Yeah. That's great.
And I love speaking now. I mean, from there, it was like, okay, the next thing, I've got to talk. Oh, and the next thing, I've got to talk. And the next thing, I've got to talk.
Yes.
It just became one of those things. I love it. I love even doing intros for other people in shows. You know, I love being like the host or the narrator. I just love it.
Yeah.
I love getting applause just by the dynamics of my intro for the other performers.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So, speaking of the Wakeling, because I use your and Mark's Wakeling as a great example of what I think that illusion should be and what I think a lot of illusions should be, because people who are listening would have heard us talk about how, when we just saw the Wakeling done, what we believe is wrong, where it's very inherently just subjugative toward the woman and very demeaning, and in fact she was offered up literally with the line, "Do you want to touch?" And it was just, it felt so gross and uncomfortable and clearly like not, she was not into that moment. And so what I love about how you have designed the Wakeling in terms of getting a microphone and speaking through it and giving the instructions is that it so clearly shows the audience that you're okay with this moment, is that you're okay becoming very uncomfortable, it looks.
Yeah.
I mean, to audience, we assume you're very uncomfortable, and but you're okay with it. And that's why that the laughter, it diffuses.
It's a release.
Exactly.
It's a release.
Exactly. But also, it's clearly consent from your perspective.
Agreed.
How was that something that came at the very beginning of the evolution?
Pretty
of that?
Much.
Okay.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, you have to go into an illusion having a pulse on your audience. You have to, there is a climate, you know, whether it's society or whether it's just your small audience, whatever your audience is, you have to read them. You have to know what they're willing to accept and what they're not. And so very early on, from the very first performance, that's why sometimes it's hard to rehearse things and truly define them until you get them in front of an audience. But the very first time we put that trick in front of an audience, I defaulted into this very real and natural place where I was comfortable and where I thought the audience would be comfortable. Mm. And so I think if you keep all of that in mind and know why you're doing something as opposed to just maybe routining something, disregarding the pulse of the audience, then you know, you'll be in better shape if you approach it from that standpoint.
Yeah. Is that part of the reason that you didn't want to go in any of the boxes?
Oh, yeah, because it was a standard cliche. In fact, it took us years to really figure out how to dissuade, I think is the right word, to the common stereotype from the top. And that's by saying it's a recreation. You know, this is how it was done. This is why this illusion was the most famous illusion in the history of magic. This is how it was done 100 years ago. This is what they did. And the fact that we do it like they did it 100 years ago kind of gives approval for it being the cliche, cut a woman in half.
Yeah.
But we do it with a presentation that's very much today.
Yes.
You know, maybe a little sass, maybe a little flirt, you know, a little normal, yeah. You know.
It just feels more authentic.
It is.
Yeah.
I think that's the key with all magic,
yeah.
You know.
So much.
It has to be authentic. Real. It has to be. It has to feel that way.
Yeah.
You know, you have to think, you have to believe it, they have to believe it. It's got to feel like a moment, you know. And the more moments you create with your audience, the better.
Yeah. Which you then have a different style of saw in half, which is the double.
Uh-huh.
And where you and Mark are separately but at the same time sawing people of male and female gender,
yeah,
in half.
And I think that's a much better version than the version we began doing, gosh, 20... That was the first illusion that we added in our repertoire because we wanted to establish the partner thing. And we realized it didn't work, you know, because we were doing exactly the same thing. We were both cutting women in half. We were both doing the exact same thing. I mean, it was a fun routine.
Sure.
Don't get me wrong. It was, you know, we had a good time. It was like fun music, happy, you know, and we did an okay job, mm-hmm. and it was a good trick. But it didn't do anything for us as a partnership.
Yeah.
You know, we were boring. It looked like we were doing the same thing. I mean, what's interesting about that?
Right.
Nothing. You know, it lessens the value of what he's doing and lessens the value of what I'm doing if we're both doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And kind of fighting for the attention from the audience. You know,
right.
Look at me. No, look at me. No, look at me. You know, as opposed to giving it to each other. So when we did the cross-gender version a few years ago, we approached it differently. You know, it's like, okay, well, we can be in sync, but we don't have to be at all the same.
Yeah.
And this cross-gender version was fun.
Yeah.
Definitely fun.
Definitely.
It was not like I wanted to, because of the historical framework, back in the day, all the assistants were men.
Right.
Sawing a man in half was the first way it was done, not sawing a woman in half. Then it became popular, you know, after the first woman was sawn in half, you know, and he demonstrates that. And then I say, sawing a man in half. That's a novel idea. I like the sound of that. So we begin it like that and then perform the trick very separately. The props don't look the same. They're all different. They're dressed like a man and a female would be dressed. And then there's the surprise ending, which is kind of fun in a way.
Well, it makes it not the typical somebody came apart and went back together. There's
yeah.
a twist.
There's
really,
a story to it.
Yeah.
And I think the audience appreciates it.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so much of your stuff is both story-based as well as relationship-based. And I know that had a lot of development through direction from Joni. Is that correct?
True. Yeah. I think there's always, you know, inherently we always knew that a trick had to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Mm-hmm. And whether you tell that story verbally or whether it's just done through visual acting, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It still needs to be done. She was the first one to actually articulate that, something that I didn't know how to recognize but that I had inherently done, but she articulated it and brought it out. She said, you always have to have an inner script. Mm-hmm. Regardless, you have to have that inner script in your head in everything that you do, because then it's crystal clear of what your intention is, and then your audience can follow along and they're part of it, that you're including them. You're not performing at them.
Right.
You're involving them.
Yes.
You know, so that was very valuable. I mean, there's just, I can go on and on and on about all the valuable pieces of information I learned from Joni. But yeah, that was a main one, you know, and that everything with that inner script, you were communicating emotion, mm-hmm. you know, that you can go see a great show and walk out of there happy and fulfilled, you know, oh, that was good.
Right.
But if you go see something that touches you,
yes,
or moves you, or yes, a movie or something that's emotional, you'll remember it for a really long time. Yep. It will stick with you. And I don't mean sad emotion. I mean any emotion,
anything,
laughter, you know, scary, whatever. It's like, it's the feeling part that sticks with people.
Yeah.
And the more you can make them feel, the better. That's what she, you know, that's why emotion was such a big deal, you know, which what she brought to Copperfield early on.
Yeah.
That's what she, you know, communicated with us. And we just happened to be really good students.
Yeah. Well, it's also, you guys had just an initial chemistry,
yeah,
on multiple levels,
yeah,
that she could very easily just come in and work with. And I always remember learning from her just the idea of authentic purpose.
Yeah. And she was great because she really customized her advice to the individuals.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like she was giving the same advice to other people that she was giving to us, because she would just bring out your best qualities, you know, or
yeah,
your most interesting qualities, or sometimes even your most vulnerable qualities.
Yes.
Because she had a sense that the audience wants to see it all. They don't want to just see the shiny, happy, perfect.
Right.
They want to see the flaws, because that makes you human.
Yep.
And, I mean, it's sort of the same. It's like a lot of the same stuff that we can see in reality television.
Yeah.
And social media and stuff. Sometimes it's more interesting to see the stuff that's less than perfect.
Yeah, as well, magic is such a just inherently powerful art form, mm-hmm, where you're able to manipulate,
yes,
space and time and objects and things.
Uh-huh.
Is that when you then let people in to be like, no, I'm just a person who,
uh-huh,
happens to do this really cool thing.
I know.
It's way more interesting than like the, you know, bird, cape, hat. Oh, I'm amazing.
I know, yeah.
I'm exhausted by that type of magic.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. Where it's nice, like, if you...
It's one level. It's not multifaceted.
Yeah, that texture,
yeah,
is so important. Mm-hmm. I love that.
Agreed.
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 Yay. Cool. So, moving on just slightly, how was FISM?
Oh, my God. It was such a great experience. It was it was amazing. I hope that everybody goes to FISM in Quebec in,
yeah,
a couple years. In, was it 21, I think?
Yeah.
I had never been. I've been in magic for 27 years. Do you believe I've never been to a FISM? That's ridiculous. So Max Maven, bless him, was the person that actually gave us the invitation, that actually caused us to go, yes, of course we'll do it. So we went over there to Busan, which was beautiful, and the Korean people that hosted it, CASA and the whole organization, FISM organization, did an amazing job. It was just so well done. We had the privilege of actually being brought over like a week early to do some public shows.
Oh, great.
For the Busan audiences, and then do FISM, and then do a couple of the, and then do a gala, a couple of the gala shows. And it was just great. It was especially good because we were doing just two pieces of material, something that Mark and I are very well known for, which is the fire spiker, you know, and do it at its best. And, you know, you could see the originators and the, you know, and it was great. And then my piece, and it was just my piece. And it was funny because that was all we were doing.
Yeah.
That was it. Just those two pieces. And so it was very equal and very, fulfilling, and it was fulfilling and stressful to share that with all the magicians, because the caliber of talent there in one location was astounding.
Yeah.
You know, and you're just, it's crazy. And so when I performed the floating ball, it was surprising and really rewarding to feel the reception that it received.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was the first time I felt established, like as an individual
yeah.
with that piece, because it was very creative and I was given the credit, you know. It was really satisfying.
Yeah.
In many ways.
So before that moment, did you not feel that the floating ball was getting you established?
No, you know, it's funny. When you do it in conjunction with other illusions, we've performed on Disney a couple of times on cruise ships, and they love the fact that they're very much the power of the princess, you know. So they love the fact that I share the stage with Mark. We go back and forth. You know, I'll do the Torn and Restored Heart, and then I'll do part of the finger rings, and I'll do, you know, the floating ball and a couple other things where I speak alone or whatever. So we share the stage very much. They love that. However, with all that recognition, we'd go up on deck, we'd talk to a couple of the passengers and the guests, and the only thing they remember is, oh, you got cut in half.
Oh no.
So when you do it, and it's funny because in the placement of the show, sometimes we have to be really careful of where it comes in the show and how it's overshadowed by a great piece of magic.
Sure.
It's a great piece of magic and it's great for me individually, but in conjunction with a bunch of other things. So when it's on its own, not compared to, oh, she's the same one that laid on that table and got cut in half.
Yeah.
It's given different context.
Do you think that as well has to do with people's understanding that it's a magician and an assistant, and that they're kind of only maybe remembering you as one role?
Sort of, yeah. I think absolutely. Although it's really funny. Even to this day, I'm still learning how to define my role within these parameters of a duo.
Yeah.
Recently, we performed with The Illusionist on a short 2-week tour in Kazakhstan. And it was amazing that the rundown of the things that we did, and I didn't do the floating ball, and I did do the wakeling, but then I did do the paper heart towards the end of the show, and they remembered that. And yet, so I got applause and recognition established as an individual more than in previous Illusionist shows. It was very interesting, just studying the order of things, you know.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
I think it's one of the reasons that we wanted to have you on is because of your talk at Magic Live this past summer, and with the understanding of the evolution of self-titling. And we talk a lot about self-titling on here because inherently, and I actually got this idea from a friend of mine's podcast called The Limit Does Not Exist, where they started doing studies of women and their ability to self-title. And they basically found out that women don't want to give themselves a powerful title. They're much more happy just kind of laying back and going, well, I'm technically the CEO, but you know, you don't have to call me that. And you're like, but that's, you did that. And so I think it's really great. And I want to touch upon your talk at length, if that's okay, just about the self-title and calling yourself a partner, as well as an illusionist, where at times you ever say, okay, in this routine I'm playing the assistant or the A word, as you call it.
Yeah.
Do you ever go, okay, right now, if this was the only piece we did, I would be playing the assistant. But then I'm going to go over here and I'm going to play the magician. Do you ever feel like there's a toggle, or are you just like, no?
No, I don't. I say I'm myself.
Good.
You know, I don't try to play a role. I didn't come into it that way. I didn't come begin magic thinking, oh, I'm going to be the assistant. To me, not knowing very much of magic 27 years ago, the cliche, the definition of an assistant was somebody very much like a Vanna White type.
Right.
You know, presenter, you know, nothing powerful like what I was experiencing and what I was getting to do. And so I just never considered myself that. I always thought that I had something to contribute.
Yeah.
And if I have something to contribute, then I want to be a part of it and grow with it and be given value with it and be proud of it. You know, I don't ever want to be given something that, you know, there's no fun in that.
Right.
You know, if somebody were to ask me 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and ask me today, what's the single motivating factor? Like, name your top 5 things that you want out of life, you know? And my number one thing has not changed, and it's to do something I'm proud of.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's great. Well, the reason I asked that question is because I've asked this question to many women who might consider themselves a partner or a magician in a partnership, mm-hmm. and then they will say, oh yeah, well, in that I'm the assistant or that. And I think it loses the effect of, like, you've earned this. You've earned the moment of saying, no, I do everything.
Yeah.
I've worked hard for this moment.
I talk about, in the Magic Live talk, I talk about establishing a complete, multifaceted body of work.
Yes.
So you don't want to be seen for just one thing. You don't want to be judged or valued for just one set apart, a la carte thing. You want to be seen for your body of work. But yet, when you only have one thing or two things that you're doing, you better figure out how to make your role, how to define your roles, exemplifying that body of work. And so sometimes, you know, people can't put their finger on it, but, you know, you'll do a traditional thing that maybe would be perceived as a magician and assistant, and they go, but she didn't seem like an assistant.
Yeah.
You know, there's that intangible thing that you've got to find.
Yeah.
You know, and that, I think it comes from being authentic and being real.
It certainly helps, because then you're more of a person as opposed to an object to be judged.
Absolutely.
Right? Absolutely. Like, the more you get a name and a persona and a purpose and a want and a point of view on the world, and the audience can see that from you.
And some duos have it just by the confidence that the individuals portray.
Yes.
And some individual performers that are females don't have it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's nobody there to hold them down.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just a matter of finding your strength.
Yeah, definitely. If somebody were to go, all right, I'm ready to find my strength.
Yeah.
How do you do that? I'm asking you a really loaded question.
That is a loaded question. I don't think there's an easy answer. I think it comes from evolution. Mm. I think they could, you know, learn from the lessons that I've shared, other people have shared, and kind of study, you know, and kind of observe. And I think that, like I said in my talk, you know, maybe it'll give them a starting place a little bit further down, but it really comes from deep down within.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It comes from a desire to learn.
Yep.
To study, to analyze, to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, you get out of it what you put into it.
Yeah.
So if you want to find your strength, you've got to put the strength in it.
Yeah, I love that. Circling back to the floating ball, because to me, it is genuinely the greatest piece of magic that exists right now.
Oh, God.
I'm not just saying it because you're here.
Ah.
I've said it, I think, on 3 different episodes.
Oh, God.
You're not living up, like, you don't have anything to live up to.
I'm blushing now.
Just a little.
I might be turning red.
But there's a reason. There's a reason that I'm going to, like, talk in a sense for you right now on, like, the reason it's so good. The reason it's so good is that it's you are a person having a relationship, like, with a thing, and then also it glows, but then it does so much, and, like, you watch sort of the evolution of a relationship go through it. Now, I don't know if that's your inner dialogue, but for me watching it, I'm just like, oh my gosh, like, this is, like, I understand the chemistry between you and this object.
That's good, because there is definitely an inner dialogue that's going on there on top of all the mechanics that I have to think about. It's not even close to being done.
Yeah.
Isn't you know, that great? It's not even close. And that's why I love magic.
Yes.
And that's why I said I will never get bored with this career. Yeah. This is something that I can work on for the rest of my life.
Yep.
Yeah. So.
And you can do the way that you've designed that routine and the relationship that exists between you and the ball. Mm-hmm. I think you can. We've also discussed a lot about ageism within entertainment like questioning the idea of, well, at what point can I no longer perform? And the answer is, well, the answer is, of course, isn't it? Like, there is no end, but you have to create routines that don't rely on your age.
Or physicality.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So this routine is something that
You can do for and I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure I consciously thought about it when I chose to do this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really didn't. I just chose it for the piece of material it was, or what it could be. You know, the fact that a glowing ball really didn't exist before really intrigued me. Yeah. You know, it started as a silver ball, then it went to a gold ball, then it went to the glowing ball.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's
so great.
I mean, it was an evolution. You know, I'm always trying to make something more unique, more special, you know, develop something that hasn't been done. Mm-hmm. That's a huge challenge, you know. And I've got a great husband that, you know, can help create. And I say help create because a lot of people think that because I have such a great minded husband that is creative, that he teaches me things. Well, it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. You know, he has fantastic ideas, but when we develop something, we develop it together.
Yeah.
I'm a big part of that.
How often did that happen, or does it happen that somebody comes backstage and says,
a lot.
Gosh, Mark, that floating ball was
actually
so
it was really
great.
Funny. But you know, and he's also really great about it too. But it happened in FISM, and I love this person to death. And he later kind of apologized, but he watched it from off stage and he just loved it. And after the show, he told Mark how much he loved it. He wasn't patting him on the back, but Mark just turned to him and he goes, "You should tell Ginger."
Yeah, she's a demon.
and he was like, "Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. I didn't even think of that." You know, so it happens a lot for whatever reason. You know, but maybe they do think that he taught it to me or created it or did it all on his own. But no, it's a collaborative effort, you know, and there's a lot of it that just has to go into the development.
Yeah. My fiance and I do not work together in terms of magic. He's not a full-time magician. He's an actor and a comedian.
Uh-huh.
And a friend of mine told me that not too long ago, somebody was like, "Oh yeah, the reason Kayla's funny is because of Harrison."
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's not true. He doesn't write for me. Like, of course we bounce things off of each other, and yes, he probably is the reason that I started training more in comedy, but certainly, like, my value does not rely upon him at all.
Right.
And it's so frustrating to hear,
right,
like, a magician friend attribute my success, not to my hard work, but to my partner.
Yeah, you're right.
So, yeah.
It's just the easy road. It's the easy explanation. It's the easy justification. It's a way to make yourself feel better.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, that person got that because of this. You know, well, it doesn't exactly work that way.
Yeah. I didn't ask you if I could ask you this, but I'm going to ask you, and then you can go, do you have an inner monologue relationship to the floating ball?
Oh, you did kind of, yes, sometimes, mostly I do, yes.
I see I can see a certain relationship, and I don't know if it's the one that you're thinking of, but it's just so, it's really refreshing to watch a performance that's not only magically brilliant, but the magic doesn't matter, right? It's like, I don't care about the method, and I don't care that it's happening. What I care
about
is the story that exists.
Well, that's nice that you can forget that for a little while, and I think that that's kind of one of our jobs.
Sure.
As magicians, illusionists, performers, I think that you are supposed to let them try to miss the part where they were supposed to figure it out.
Yeah.
Let them miss that altogether. They go, oh, I forgot to try to look and see. You know, if you can get them to do that, then you've succeeded.
Yeah.
But as far as the inner dialogue, the only thing that I want to say about that is whether it's the same inner dialogue you think that I'm having, or whether it's one. Sometimes, I mean, I guess in general, it's okay for people to interpret things on their own.
Yeah, of course.
I think they walk away with a more personalized experience if the inner dialogue, the way it's outwardly communicated, is not so specific that it knocks them off over the head.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not like the I'm hungry school of acting, like, ooh, I'm hungry, you know, as you rub your belly. You know, it's not like, oh, do you need a hug or a baby face? You know, it's not that kind of inner dialogue.
Right.
It's more of an inner dialogue that can be interpreted
mm-hmm.
by the viewer in their own personal way.
Yeah.
That's going to touch them. That's why sometimes the Wakeling, again, is another example.
Absolutely.
The imagination of what's happening inside those boxes, those closed boxes. Sometimes people don't even remember that we closed the box.
Yeah, right.
They think they see the whole time. They're like, because what's going on in their imagination is so far greater than what we're.
Yeah.
So I think allowing your audience to interpret stuff in their own unique way is more powerful than anything. The fact that I probably have less of an inner dialogue with that ball than you see it. Because I have to leave it a little bit vague, and it changes
mm-hmm.
sometimes
mm-hmm.
and I play with that because I want people to get different things from it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I'd like to pretend that what I'm saying is like the same level as you, but at the same time I'm just like, this is so much fun. It's so good. If you haven't seen it, folks, do it. I don't know how. Where, like, is there, for people who can reference it, like, what shows are you doing
right,
in the near future?
We're going to be out of the country for the holidays. We're going to be in Australia with The Illusionist for December and January.
Oh, great. We do have some Australian listeners.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Hey,
oh,
Tim.
Oh, my gosh.
It's really just one.
Oh,
just
I know Tim.
Hey, Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Maybe other people, but we really don't look at the statistics.
Yeah, no, we'll be in Tim's from Melbourne, and we're adding Melbourne, right, Tim?
Tim, Ellis?
I think he's from Melbourne.
Tim, where are you from?
I think he's from Melbourne.
Sounds good.
I'm pretty sure. Anyway, we've added Melbourne the last week of the tour. So we're in Canberra and in Sydney at the Sydney Opera House again, which is unbelievable.
Yes, I'm so,
right on the heart. Yeah.
So it's amazing.
That's another like one of those like blessed like
yes.
milestone, like, oh my God, I get to perform here.
Yes.
Yeah. And then Brisbane at the QPAC. And then Melbourne.
Nice.
Yeah. So it'll be nice.
If you're in Australia, you can go to the Illusionist website. And,
absolutely.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And
they're going to love the fact that you just gave them this shout out.
Yeah. Technically, I've just given
a competitor
show a shout out. But we're not doing an Australian tour yet.
No,
so I don't have to worry about
it. It's media.
It's also magic. So like,
yeah.
I'm just happy.
It's
people
all
go to
we're
shows.
All happy.
Yes,
we're all happy. We all benefit
so much.
But yeah, well, and then after that, I think we're going to be a week at the castle.
Oh, great!
The first week of February, I want to say.
Oh,
I want to
awesome.
Say. I don't know what the first Monday of February is, but that's when we open.
And you'll be doing the full 45 minutes in the
palace. Show.
So good.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Brilliant. I wanted to talk about, like, your expertise first,
mm-hmm.
Because I think it's really important that people, if they don't already know your work, understand that you have a lot of, like, a big body of work.
Uh-huh.
But I do want to touch upon the Magic Live Talk
uh-huh.
In a little bit more detail than we have. So, this past year, you gave a talk at Magic Live. In essence, it was the A word, right?
Well, it was kind of gender-centric a little bit. It was just, without preaching, I wanted to touch upon my personal experiences as defining my role as a female in magic. And I've had to do that within the parameters of a duo, which is unique, you know. But there's all kinds of females in magic, and it doesn't really matter, you know, which you are, which you choose, but that it's important to talk about and to communicate the type of perception that you want to be perceived as, you know, and just really define those roles.
Yeah, great.
You know, I'm not sure what part of that talk you really, you know, you're most interested in.
I think it's really the idea of the self-titling and the idea that you came into this knowing that the dynamic between you and Mark was not going to be power not power relationship.
Right.
And one of the reasons I love you guys so much is that if one of you is performing, then one of you might just go off for a minute to do whatever you need to do, and then vice versa. And like that partnership and that dynamic was so strong, which didn't really, to me, I had never seen a performing partnership do something like that before.
Right.
It had always been the assistant does what she's supposed to do and the magician does all of the other powerful stuff. But instead you were given such a powerful role that from the audience perspective, there wasn't...
Can I correct you?
Yes.
I wasn't given the role.
You gave yourself the role.
I established the role.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry, that's
I created.
What I meant.
Yeah. But that's common.
Yeah.
You know, it's sometimes and this is gonna bother a lot of people, and I don't mean any offense by it. But I think sometime, just talking about that slip up right there, it has to do with introductions.
Yeah.
There's something about when a magician gives credit to a female on stage.
Mm, yes.
Isn't she great?
Oh, God.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's hear it for so-and-so.
Yes.
On the surface, it's giving credit.
Right.
Subsurface, it's saying, I have the power to give as much credit as she is going to get.
Yeah, right.
So I think sometimes when I get introduced, I'm going to introduce you right back.
I love that. That's so great.
You know, ladies and gentlemen, Ginger Lee and Mark Kalin.
Yes. Yes. This is fantastic.
Yeah. So he becomes the end.
Yes. I love that. Oh, that's fantastic.
And I get to say it.
Done.
I get to give it.
Oh, done. We've just changed the title of your whole act. I love it. Yeah, I think that's great.
You just have to think about those kinds of things. And you have to think about what sits right with people.
Yeah.
You know, the swapping of time with the audience is something that, you know, we dabbled in with Carnival of Wonders. You know, there were certain pieces that I did with Hobson or on my own without Mark, you know, and that was kind of neat. Mm. But we really hadn't applied it as much to our duo, to our performing act, as much as we do now, you know, just giving each other more time alone on stage is valuable, because there's a connection that you make with the audience that just that solo time is sort of invaluable. It's that connection, that chemistry. It's that, you know, this is who I am. Let me know who you are, you know. And it's a little bit harder to do when both of you are on stage.
Yeah.
You know.
Yep, absolutely. So what sort of brought about your passion for making this talk for Magic Live?
I don't know. You know, I guess underneath it probably was something that I've been thinking about for a long time, but probably just because it's so topical now about, you know, women's forward motion.
Yeah.
I guess that I want to call it that, because I don't know, you know, the time for change, whatever, you know, whatever you want to call it. I just think that, you know, we've been here, and I've fought my whole career to keep going forward, that now with this extra momentum, and also I feel like it's sort of my place now.
Yeah.
You know, I've been around a long time, and I got lots of stuff to pass along.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't come easy, but I have a lot of insight to pass along. So if I can share that and help the momentum of the forward motion, then great. And it was when Stan came to me and he said, we'd like you to talk about a topic, you know, throw out some things you want to talk about, you know, I didn't want to just do a totally female-centric type of, like, we deserve this and we deserve that and it's not what I'm about, you know, but I did want to share my personal experiences, and then maybe people could learn something, extract something from that. And it was the only thing I could think of that I was passionate about, so I put it into a talk that I was equally as knowledgeable about, and that's our magic.
Yeah. I think that's great. And yeah. The emphasis on language there, on the titles and language, just, you know, we're all still, like, trying to figure all of that out, and we talk a lot about the idea of female magician as a mm-hmm. title, which I hate.
Yeah.
Other people embrace, but I have a lot of problem with it, and,
yeah.
and I think that the more that we can acknowledge partnerships
mm-hmm.
and the more we can acknowledge the power of women, right? It's like this,
yeah.
that's so strong in our industry. And so I love that you gave this talk.
Yeah.
Because it is pushing a tiny little snowball down the hill.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can keep pushing it.
I've always liked people coming up with creative titles for things,
yeah.
you know? I mean, I'm surprised I haven't come up with a more creative title than illusionist,
yeah.
you know? There's illusionist. I don't know.
That's fantastic.
But, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I just think we have to keep challenging ourselves and pushing ourselves and, you know... Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
That's the secret.
We figured it out.
We figured it out. That's it.
Magic secret ever. Done. So we are at the end of time, but mm-hmm. before we go, we always like to play a little bit of a lightning round.
Yay!
Adventure. But, okay, are you ready? Oh my
one
god.
Word. Did they have any one word answers?
No, they can honestly be as long as you want.
Okay.
Okay, so lightning round questions. You ready?
Ready.
What is your favorite magic routine that you've ever seen?
Oh god.
I just hit something in excitement.
I probably have several, but I can't think of one that stands out right now. The most favorite magic routine.
I mean, trick I have, is also in there.
I have a couple of them.
Yeah.
I don't know. It could be Mousetrap by Henning. It could be the Water Levitation by Copperfield. You know, there's routines by Darren Brown that were great. Derek's routine was one of Derek's routine in and of itself was really good.
Delgadio.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of which one. It was the one where he had to recite all the things back with the.
The I am.
Yeah, like I think it was the I am.
Yeah.
That was a great routine.
Yeah.
That was a great routine.
Great. We'll put in all of those.
I'm so sorry.
I think it's perfect.
I have so many. I can't.
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you're allowed to say multiple.
Yeah,
we have no
there's
rules here.
Multiple.
We have no rules.
Oh, and of course, the Pendragon Subtrunk is like
great. Oh
flawless.
My gosh.
Magical, one. Magical beyond belief.
Yep. What is your go to magic resource?
You mean as far as like a book or.
It can be a book, it can be an online source, it can be a person, it could be.
Caveny! Mike Caveny! He is my go to when I have a question.
Yes.
And in fact, yeah, anytime I have a question, I don't even ask Mark. Well, I mean, sometimes I'll ask him, but he'll say, I'll ask Mark, do you think Caveny would know? I know, that's so bad.
No, I love
but
that.
Yeah.
I have also sent many an email,
yeah.
so I totally understand. That's awesome. Yay, my Caveney. That might not be for everybody, but
no,
yes,
I know.
I
but
totally
yeah,
agree.
It's a person.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll usually ask. I mean, if not, I'll go online and like read,
mm-hmm.
you know, like I was researching women in magic when I was getting interviewed on Broadway. I mean, when
yeah,
I
yeah, great.
Yeah. So I had to like go online and find like history
yes.
about that. I love that stuff. I love the written stuff about it was like, it's like reading a soap opera.
Yeah.
If you like read the history of all the magic performers back around the turn of the century, it's fascinating.
Yep.
It's amazing. It's like the movie The Prestige.
Yes.
You know, it's like that, that competitive yet interesting. These people have quirks, they have problems, they have issues. There's guys, there's females, there's, you know, females that are taking over from their husbands. It's amazing.
Have you read Adelaide Herman's memoirs yet?
I haven't read the whole
Great.
Book, but I have read the synopsis.
It's what I love about that book and what Margaret has done in addendum to the memoirs
mm-hmm.
is that Margaret literally said, you know, Adelaide sometimes didn't tell the truth,
mm-hmm.
and so I've created this whole extra part of the book that corrects her about her own life.
Oh, that's
like,
funny.
This is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They all did that.
Oh, yeah.
They all did it.
Everybody does,
yeah.
right? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I love it. This lightning round is
not a lightning round. Sorry, Max Maven, I'm taking your record.
That's fine. I think we have a little bit more time in order to beat his record, but yes. I hope he listens. What are you reading right now?
Nothing.
Magic or non?
You know, I read a lot of the newspapers. Mm. You know, if I can just stay up, I read a lot of, like, CNN or The Times or stuff online. Our news is really pretty interesting in this day and age.
You mean now?
Yeah.
What? I don't know what you're talking about.
The newspapers.
That's great. That's awesome. I think it's important, though, to stay up on information, right? Not only just in life, but also as a performer, to know who you're performing for.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
It's true. You want to see, want to see the wide, vast of...
Yeah. Wide. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. This might be a slightly longer answer, but what do you think needs to happen for us to become obsolete?
Oh, wow. It's going to be a long, long road. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think it's... I don't think there's anything... I'm not even going to venture to answer that.
Yeah.
Because I don't think there's anything that we're going to do that there's, like, one thing. I think it's a series of things, if it ever becomes obsolete, because I think there'll always be a need of an awareness. I just don't think that it'll need to be exactly the same.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, maybe it won't be called Shazam, and maybe it won't be... so centered on the rights of females or, you know, what should be done or what's the right thing to do. Maybe it'll evolve a little bit to what women are actually doing in magic, based on the successes and the things that other podcasts talk about. You know, let's talk about the directors in the business. Yeah. Let's talk about the producers that are women and the writers that are women and the magicians that are women. And, you know, let's talk about all the women that are having great, you know, success.
Absolutely. That's great. Is there a woman in our industry you want to give a shout out to?
There's a lot of women in magic. I think, no, I wouldn't say individually. I would name a person, but there are girls, women, females in magic that I respect greatly, and I think they might know who they are. But I love the fact that, and I said this to you off recording earlier, that there is now a greater sisterhood happening. You know, magic has always had a brotherhood, but it's never really had a sisterhood. If you were in the IBM, even if you're a female, you were in the International Brotherhood of Magicians.
Right.
Yeah. So now there's just a bonding that I didn't see before that is happening amongst the females in magic. And it's less competitive and more productive. It's forcing innovation, but not from a competition standpoint, but from a nurturing standpoint.
Yeah.
I really like that. I like to be part of that. Whether I'm on one side or the other, I think I lean more towards the nurturing side.
Yeah.
But I'm enjoying it.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. All right. Very important question. Big dogs or little dogs?
Little dogs. Oh, but fine. I like big dogs too.
Fine.
I used to have one of each.
Oh, that's fun.
I had like 116 pound.
Yes.
Yes. Like mutt mix. He was like a pit lab.
Yes.
You know. Pointer mix, and then we have a mini dachshund, Chili.
A mini dachshund.
A mini black spot.
Oh my gosh!
and the big dog Mikey was like a white ghost. He was like big and white and like just gigantic. So it was like this 15 pound dog and a 115 pound dog. So I like both. They were like yin and yang. They were perfect together.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So I can't say one or the other.
All right, that's fair.
We just have the little lug left.
That's okay. Great. Yeah. How do you take your coffee?
Light and sweet.
Mm. All right. Picture this scenario. You are stranded on an island. You are dying of hunger.
Mm-hmm.
And you go through the island and you find a shack. And inside of this shack, somehow, with no electricity, you have found a tub, like a freezer, full of ice cream. What flavor do you choose?
Coffee
ice cream?
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's delicious.
Uh-huh.
What toppings?
Oh, sprinkles.
Great. Rainbow or chocolate?
Rainbow.
Nice.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah.
That's great.
I like caramel topping too, but...
Okay.
Yeah.
On the coffee or...
No.
Okay.
I like caramel like on Sundays and stuff.
Oh, great.
I'm a big ice cream girl.
Yes.
If you were to ask me my two favorite desserts, I'd say ice cream and cookies. If you were to ask Mark his two favorite desserts, he'd say cake and pie.
What kind of pie does he like?
Coconut cream. It's his favorite. And vanilla birthday cake.
And vanilla birthday
with buttercream frosting.
Does he get vanilla birthday cake when it's not his birthday?
Yes.
All of this makes sense. It all just clicks in. 100%. Amazing.
And my favorite candy is Skittles.
Skittles.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I'm a big Skittles fan.
All right.
So whenever anyone wants to get on my good side, they buy me a bag of Skittles.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Good to know. I know what I'm doing. Great. Oh, Ginger, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
This is awesome.
Kayla, you're awesome. Thank you.
You're awesome. This is great.
I hope I didn't bore the listeners.
No. I think you're fine. Thank you.
This podcast is funded in part through support from the Endowment and Development Fund of the International Brotherhood of Magicians. Thank you so much for helping us out, you guys. We really appreciate it.